What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time's here.
Come with me if you want to live.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
The Force will be with you. Always.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to 20th Century Geek. I'm your regular host, Scott Weatherly, and I'm continuing to go up and away with this Superman retrospective. And I'm joined once again by Max Byrne as we continue the Snyderverse. Max, how are you doing? You okay?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on again, Scott. Yeah, I'm right here. Ready to talk more Superman, more Snyder.
Yeah,
bit of Batman, bit of Wonder Woman, bit of everything.
Bit of everything. Yeah, a smorgasbord of DC superheroage in this film.
There is.
We are going to be talking Batman v Superman from 2016. I think both of you and I were in a similar boat with this one of not having watched it for quite a few years. I mean, it's been a bit of time. And also, I assume you watched the Ultimate Edition.
I did indeed. Yes, I dug the disc out from the wardrobe and blew the dust off and cranked it up. Yeah. So, It's definitely a much more rewarding viewing experience than the theatrical cut. You know, I mean,
yes.
Granted, it's 3 hours. It's quite an investment of time, but I do think it's a much better version than what was, you know, the 2.5 hour that was in the cinema for sure.
I agree. I absolutely agree that. Narratively and sort of even like, you know, just everything feels, it's not that it's the director's cut, you can tell that goes, well, that was the film and then there was half an hour taken out of it for the theatrical cut, so it just feels like a whole piece, which is better. So I agree.
There's a lot more cohesion to it, isn't there? You know, I think it's more rounded. I mean, there's nothing in there that massively reinvents the wheel as such. It's not like huge, you know, cut sequence or dramatic inclusion of something that wasn't there, but it's just a bit more to it. There's a bit more meat on the bone with the sort of the mystery, the investigation. We get that character played by Jenna Malone, who I remember at the time when it was like, oh yeah, she's going to be in that cut, everyone was like, oh, that's she's going to be Barbara Gordon, I tell you. Now she's going to be Barbara Gordon. A bit disappointed there. But other than that, and a tantalizing little glimpse of Steppenwolf, which I'd completely forgotten about. That was a surprise.
Yeah, but you're right. I think I say, because the mystery at the heart of this, it does just make that make more sense.
Yeah.
And that sort of, because that's the sort of the key underpinning thing throughout the whole thing. I remember seeing the theatrical version coming out going, I'm not entirely sure why some of these things happened. And then you watch the Ultimate Edition and you're like, It that makes a lot more sense now. Like as you said, that's sort of, there's more meat on the bone because there's some more connective tissue there that you just say, all right, that just makes more sense. All right, I'm good with that now. One of the things we'd said about the Man of Steel though movie was the tone that had been chosen, and really, I sort of, you know, it's very different, obviously, to what had gone before. And you know, I think we both sort of said, for the most part, it kind of works in Man of Steel. It's not a bad thing. A different take, you know, it is kind of a little bit divisive as to whether or not, you know, sort of Clark would be as sort of petty as he is in some parts of that film. But what are your thoughts on the tone continuing into this film? That sort of darker, I'm not even going to say grittier, but like that darker, sort of more, maybe grittier, slightly more cynical sort of version of these characters.
Yeah, they definitely carry on from where Man of Steel left off, literally and figuratively, with the start of the film. But yeah, I mean, it is incredibly grim and dark. And as we were saying before we started talking here, a very humorless film, isn't it? There's hardly any levity in a couple of jokes here and there, and Alfred has some good one-liners, but I suppose it fits the world because it's supposed to be a reflection of what the world would think based off the end of Man of Steel. So although Superman is an incredibly noble and, you know, heroic character, selfless man, there's that the world views him with distrust and fear. Yeah. Because they're not quite sure, you know, they're fully aware that if he decided to, he could kill everyone on Earth and nobody could stop him.
Yeah.
At least so they think.
Yeah.
So I guess it would be hard for them to go from what they'd established in Man of Steel and then completely lighten it up, especially with bringing Batman into the proceedings and this particular version of Batman, who's a really dark, you know, Batman with 20 years worth of baggage and you know, it's been through a lot, shall we say. So I think I'm fine with the tone being like it is, because it feels like a worthy continuation of Man of Steel. You know, you get a lot of people who are like, oh, I feel really sorry for Henry Cavill because he never got a Man of Steel 2. Well, isn't this kind of...
Yeah, as you say, it's a continuation, isn't it? Like, it works.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I find interesting about this is the tone works because it's of a piece. This is like one of those auteur kind of things. This is the Zack Snyder DCEU. So I'm kind of like, I'm fine with it in that sense.
Mm.
And I can't fault Ben Affleck's Batman.
Mm.
You know, there's obviously this thing of like, oh, he's violent and he does this. But it's like this, watching it, this, I think I had that sense of like, this isn't my Batman, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
When I was watching this sort of, you know, years ago, and so getting tied up in that. But you watch it now, and as you say, this is just a different take. This is a kind of, you know, oh, this is Batman that's been jaded after 20 years. And there's the line of when he says to, you know, Alfred, of like, you know, we've always been criminals, kind of thing. But also like 20 years of like, working his ass off and like really not quite getting anywhere in Gotham City. So it kind of makes sense that this is the moment. The problem, the issue I have though, is the other side, is Henry Cavill Superman. I agree that you're saying it's a continuation of Man of Steel, but one of the things this film does, it keeps saying how virtuous and how noble and how good Superman is.
Mm.
And, but then when it never really shows me. Like, there's a line when, like, Bruce Wayne at the party sort of says about, you know, every time, you know, Superman saves a cat from a tree, you write a puff piece about him kind of thing. And I'm going like, yeah, I've not really seen him, you know, you see him sort of doing a couple of things, but it's always kind of dramatic. Like, there's a woman at one point like that, you know, there's a massive flood and he's got the Superman thing on the... you know, on the roof and all that kind of stuff. You're like, cool. And it looks up and he's just hanging there in the sky. And I'm like, he's not rescuing anyone. He's kind of left them in, you know, you've got to show you can't just show the dramatic shot. You've got to show him being sort of like compassionate and all this other stuff. So I kind of feel that, you know, it kind of lets Superman down, that thing, because they want to show him as this, you know, they want to deify him as this demigod. But it kind of also makes him a little bit cold and standoffish, which is where I think the film sort of falls short.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think they don't give Cavill a huge amount to do in this film other than look really silent and miserable.
Yeah.
I lost count of the number of scenes where he's reacting to something bad. You know, when he goes to see his mother and she's like, oh, you know, be the savior of the world or be nothing. It's, you know, they don't owe him anything. It's your choice. He doesn't speak. He just kind of looks a bit like, you know, a bit of a grimace. When the court, jumping ahead here, but when the courtroom gets incinerated, he's just sort of stood there looking bloody miserable. There's not, well, I suppose he's got an excuse.
Yeah.
But he's not given a huge amount to do. You know, there's shots, numerous scenes of him in his flat, you know, cooking or watching TV, watching the press is saying about him. And again, he's just sort of sat there looking puzzled by it all. So I don't think, you know, I think although it's everything in this film is a direct continuation and consequence of what happens in Man of Steel, but I do think that in many ways he is a secondary character in this film to Batman.
Yes.
Batman's got more screen time than him. If you look at the screen tally, he's in it more. I think they give Batman more to do. Batman has more of an arc well. Superman at the start of the film is kind of the same person he is at the end of the film. He always was. It's just a perception of him. So I think, you know, there's not enough meat on the bone for Superman in this film, other than some, you know, some cool action sequences and whatnot. But I just think he's, I think he lies down and takes it a bit, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. That's a really good point. I mean, because the whole thing sort of centers on this mystery that sort of at the start of the film. And this is one of those films, there were certain films around this era and even earlier that just have like multiple beginnings. Like this film starts about four or five times where you have like, we're going to have a flashback and then we're going to introduce this and then we're going to introduce this. And they all feel that, like they've all been filmed and set up like they're the start of the film. So it takes a while to get going. But once it gets to this sort of, I don't know where it's supposed to be, Middle Eastern, African or whatever, this village, remote sort of desert village, is the incident there where Lois is sort of let in. She's there to sort of meet this general. And she's then put under duress. She's taken hostage or whatever. And then Superman turns up, puts a guy through what, four walls?
There's no way that guy walked away unscathed. No, I don't care.
He didn't walk away at all. Like the guy was turned into like Marmite by the end of it. It's kind of like this thing where he's just sort of like, that guy's turned into sort of, yeah, into pasta sauce and he's on the side. And then the whole thing is like, it turns out to be Lex Luthor's men kill a bunch of other people. And then, they set up this woman to then start saying the story of like, it was her family that was killed and how this tragedy and Superman killed all these people, blah, blah, blah. And you go, yeah, he's been set up. And I'm going, No, he did kill someone. he did kill someone. So like, he didn't kill these innocents. He killed this general who said, but he still killed someone. And it's kind of weird to have this weird. It's they want you to feel sympathy. And as you say, he's so kind of like passive in this whole thing. That you go, you want. I am going like, go say something. Like, go see someone. Like, you know. Weirdly, I could imagine like Christopher Reeve sort of Superman, sort of like turning up at the White House and being like, you know, Mr. President, I've got to speak to you about kind of thing. Like, you know, at least trying to defend himself. It's this odd opening scene that.
It is. I mean, you get why it happens. But, you know, obviously we find out later that, you know, they deliberately positioned it so Lois would be there because I can't remember now if they refer to the fact that the African general warlord, whatever he is, like specifically requested her, or she was specifically given that gig to go out there and interview him. And of course, obviously it's because Luthor knows that he knows who Superman really is. He knows he's Clark Kent. He knows therefore he's in the relationship with Lois. And that's the only way to get him out there is to put Lois in harm's way. Cause you know, if you do that, he'll turn up at the drop of a hat to save a life. At first you think it's a bit of a contrivance before they start to unravel and the layers start to get peeled back. And obviously Luthor knows everything already and he's, you know, manipulating both sides, Batman and Superman, to, you know, come to this inevitable collision at the end. It's a very strange scene. It's just... I'm frustrated with Superman in this film. He has so many opportunities to do something about his situation. I'm jumping so far ahead here, but even at the end,
jump all over the place.
Even at the end, when he goes to see Batman because Luthor's like, you must go to see Batman and you must fight him to the death, or I'll kill your mother. And before he goes, he says to Lois, "I've got to fight him, or persuade him to help me." That's what he says. But he barely says anything before he's like, "Oh, fuck it, let's just fight." You know? Considering his mother's got an hour to live and he's just going to start throwing Batman around. He just starts throwing Batman through walls. And buildings and that.
I need his help. I need his help or he's got to die, is what he says. And the thing that struck me this time is he starts trying to talk to Batman. And he says, "You don't understand." And then he sort of say things. And then finally, when Batman has him sort of, you know, uses the kryptonite and has him pinned down, and he sort of like struggle. We'll get to the whole Martha controversy, but you know, he just sort of says, you know, save Martha, and you're like, all I can think of is, aren't you a journalist? Isn't your job words and conveying information? Like,
yeah,
this should be much more like, you know, concise. Of like, he should just fall. He should, even landing is a waste of time. He should just like fly up, hover, and be like, right, this is what's happened. This is where we're at. I'm giving you the choice. It doesn't.
Why not? Why not do that? Why not say, look, I'm here under duress because Lex Luthor has blackmailed me into being here. He's literally got my mother held captive somewhere. She's got less than an hour to live. Help me. And he even calls him Bruce at that point, because he found out ages ago who he was from the hearing the Alfred on the intercom at Luther's party. You know, why not do that? I don't quite get it. I mean, obviously it's the excuse for them to have this fantastic Dark Knight Returns-esque fight. And obviously it would be a bit of a letdown. The film is called Batman v Superman, so they have to fight, obviously. But yeah, it's, and like I said before, I'm really frustrated with Superman in this film. Really frustrated. I mean, to me, it's the Batman show. I think he steals the film from underneath Superman. I really do. And for all the things that, you know, people dislike about this film, and there are plenty of things, people out there who hate this film or say, I don't like this, I don't like that, I never hear anybody ever say, and I thought Ben Affleck was rubbish as Batman. People generally really seem to have liked his performance as Batman. I think it's a crying shame that he, that much, you know, anticipated standalone film that he was going to write and direct. And Deathstroke was going to be the baddie and blah, 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 blah. That never happened. It's a real, you know, massive lost opportunity that never happened. And obviously there's a chain of events that come after this film, and with Warner Brothers and Justice League and Snyder Cut, blah, 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 blah. But it's such a shame that it never happened, because I think Affleck was a superb Batman. I really do.
No, I agree. I think also I would say it's very rare, I don't know if it's ever really happened, that we've had, like, you know, we've inserted into the almost like the tail end or the you know, the end of a story. I mean, this is, as you sort of said, a sort of a Batman with 20 years worth of baggage. You know, he's already lost a Robin. You know, we know that there's been like pain and loss, and this is a sort of a guy that's gone through some shit. I'm sure he was that sort of idealistic but angry young man sort of 20 years before, and now he's this, you know, this absolutist, this sort of moral absolutist. And so, no, I actually like him, but his performances, like Ben Affleck has a sort of a cool about him, doesn't he? Like, which makes him work as Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think he looks like you imagine Bruce Wayne to look, doesn't he? He has the, you know, other Batman, I think for all the brilliance that Keaton brought to all, it's just my opinion here, but I always thought he was a little bit too slight. You know, he's not a big man. He's not physically imposing. And I always envisage my Bruce Wayne / Batman as being 6 foot something, you know, 220 pounds, whatever, jacked to within an inch of his life, all of which Affleck was bringing to the party here. So I think he's the most cinematic Batman, if that makes sense. I think, you know, I think he has the Bruce Wayne look and the charm, the charisma and that, but I think he's Batman, because this isn't a Christopher Nolan Dark Knight Batman. That wouldn't work here, because that's a very grounded version of Batman, much like the you know, the Pattinson Batman that would come after this. So you've got to have a Batman that's slightly larger than life to fit into this universe, where he's going to be stood alongside Superman, and in the future he's going to be stood alongside the Flash and Aquaman and Wonder Woman. And I think that's what he brings to it. I think he's really good as Batman. I think he's excellent.
No, I agree. I think he's, yeah, if you take him as two different things, you're right. I think, you know, his Bruce Wayne is cool and relaxed. I think that's the kind of thing I like about him, that he enters his thing and he's kind of a relaxed guy. He sort of knows what he wants to do. He's kind of sort of, he's one of those guys that, If you've watched the show Reacher,
oh, very much so, yeah, it's great,
yeah, that kind of thing that, like, he has that Alan Richardson brings to that, where he's like, I know I could deck everyone in this room if I wanted. And so I'm kind of just chill about everything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. There's that great scene where he's at the, like the illegal bare knuckle fight, isn't he? Because he's there to, he's there to clone the phone of,
KG Beast. He gives the guy some info and stuff like that.
Cause you know, if he was in there, he'd literally take any comer, all comers on, you know. If he entered UFC, he'd be undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, undefeated, you know, because no one's going to beat him in a one-on-one fair fight. There's that kind of laconic quality to him.
Yes.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, don't, like you're saying about the 20 years and losing the Robin, you know, also Wayne Manor is completely just a burnt out derelict shell at this point. So much has happened over those 20 years that we're not privy to, because obviously we're not meeting him until this point of his life. You know, and you can see, you know, this is a Bruce Wayne that's in disarray. There's a scene where he wakes up and there's some anonymous, nameless girl asleep in the bed next to him. Some, you know, one night stand. And you can imagine once she wakes up, will probably be given a ride back to the city and probably never see him ever again, you know.
Oh, no. Yeah. Alfred gives her is the one driving the car.
Oh, no. That's an Uber. An Uber on the Wayne expense account, that one. Yeah. But yeah, and you know, as soon as he wakes up, he's throwing a pill down and washing it down with last night's glass of wine. You know, it's a Batman who's really, really, really reached his lowest step. So, you know, people have a problem with how far he goes in this film in terms of, you know, his actions and his sort of very liberal attitude to killing baddies. But you can see how far he's gone down. I mean, I know you're not that massive fan of him killing, are you, in this film?
No, it's the Batman killing on screen is a because it's hard. It's difficult to defend because it's supposed to be sort of like, you know, the thing. But it's also kind of difficult to, you know, to kind of hold them up for it, to punish them for it, because Keaton's Batman kills people in both Batman and Batman Returns.
Exactly.
I mean, in Batman Returns, I love those films, you know, with, like you say, with weird Keaton and his sort of like goth Batman. But at one point, he straps dynamite to a clown and throws him in a basement. Like,
yep.
So it's not unsort of, you know, and if you want to talk about reckless, again, like the Batwing just coming down, swooping down and firing on everything in Batman. Like, so it's not unheard of. But I do have a bit of a problem with him killing. But it's more, I think the thing in this one is, again, having watched it this time, it sets that tone of, you know, this is, as you said, the jaded, he's kind of broken Batman. Like, he's on the edge. Like, you know, this is his last chance, that this redemption he sort of takes at the end, which we'll get to. What I kind of have a problem, though, is, as you say, is the recklessness of it. Of him at times, and you know, the fight at the end, the warehouse fight, is great. I mean, it's some great choreography. Like, it's a it's a smashing fight. The bit I have kind of problem with is there's a scene where he fires a tracking device onto the back of a truck,
yes,
in order to follow it, and then follows it using the Batmobile, but then within about 3 minutes has plowed through the back of the truck right where he put the tracking device and stuff. You know, like, What was the point in all that? Like, that also seems kind of pointless now.
It's. I mean, I guess obviously they want action spectacle in this film, but yeah, there just doesn't seem to be any effort to sort of avoid having to kill people. You know, I mean, you know, he's not there. You know, shooting people and what have you, you know, shooting people in the head and things like that. But yeah, like you said, he'll literally, you know, blow up a truck with, you know, there's when that very scene you're talking about, there's a guy hanging at the back of the truck with like a mounted gun firing at the Batmobile, and he literally blows said truck up. And there's like three guys in that, I think two in front and the guy in the back with the gun. They're all dead. You're not walking away from that. You're dead. And there's several scenes like that, you know, before the like you said, the amazing warehouse fight, he turns up to that warehouse in the Batwing and mows down from above, there's like a row of them in cars. Mm. Or, I can't remember now, or cars with guns, something like that. And they all get completely mown down before he jumps out and goes into the warehouse. So, yeah, you know, you could argue some deaths are a byproduct, right? The guy who he knocks the grenade out the guy's hand, and before he can retrieve it, the guy gets blown up. So you can say there's some that are not direct. But yeah, there's very definitive moments of him taking life here.
Yeah. Yep. I like to say very definitive moments of taking life. You mean he kills people? Like he murders. But no, I like the fact that he is scary.
Mm.
Like they make him scary. Like when you know, because whenever I've seen when other cinematic versions of Batman that have sort of come before this, there is this kind of note of fear is the thing, and you watch. I mean, maybe the opening scene of 89 Batman, where he sort of does the cape and he comes down and stuff. It's kind of cool. But beyond that, it always feels a little bit kind of, you look at a dude and go, some dude in a weird suit. Mm. And we've that thing of fear, like there's, the Schumacher ones don't really go down that route. They're much more, rich campier.
Friendly, aren't they?
Yeah, that sort of thing. But there's always been this notion of like, and they've played it up in the more recent, the Batman. But to me, this is like the first time where I was like, no, this guy is legit scary. Like, if you were a criminal and you got trapped in an alleyway with this guy and you got caught, like, no, you're going to get branded or you're going to have something broken.
Yeah,
it feels like this is a legit scary dude doing, vigilante justice. So, yeah, I like Affleck. I like Batfleck. Suit's great as well. Like his suit is awesome.
It's less sort of armored and more. It looks more like a fabric-y kind of thing. Obviously, they've done the typical superhero trope of putting like a muscle suit underneath it to make him look fucking huge. But what you were saying about him being scary is so spot on as well. The very first time you see him in costume in this film, it's that scene where the cops in Gotham are called to the scene where there's a lot of women in a cage who I presume they're going to be sex trafficked or something like this. And they're scared to come out of the cage. And, she's speaking it in Chinese or some other language, forgive me. But she's saying, there's a devil here. The devil saved us and he's still upstairs. And although they've been saved, they're literally scared to come out of the cage because they think he's going to get them.
I like that response.
Oh, yeah. But then when you first see him in said scene, when the cops go upstairs with a shotgun, and he's sort of in the top corner of the room, isn't he? Just hanging into the wall. And he looks like a monster. He doesn't look, he doesn't look like heroic. It's heroic Batman, the savior of Gotham City. He looks like an absolute monster. And then when the guy starts, unloading the shotgun, trying to take him down, the way he moves across the ceiling and up through the hole, it's like a monster, like an animal. It's you've never seen that kind of thing before.
No, and that's what I like. They do. They've taken that kind of route of making him. I do love that moment when they're sort of like, you're safe now. And the women go, not a chance, and pull the door shut. And they're like, he's still here. I mean, that's kind of horror movie-esque. They're leaning into those sort of like, horror tropes and stuff. So I do appreciate that they do that. And it sets the stakes as sort of this, this Batman being much scarier and much sort of a hard line on these things.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder if that's happened because the start of the film is him being down on the ground whilst the Battle of Metropolis, I guess you call it, at the end of Man of Steel happens. But then there's an 18-month jump forward in time, isn't there, between Superman killing Zod and then where we pick the story up. And there's that, at the start, he seems like a very heroic, altruistic Bruce Wayne. He's literally running into danger. Not as Batman, as Bruce Wayne. He's not in costume, trying to save the people in Metropolis. I mean, there's that wonderful shot of him running into the dust cloud while everyone else is running out. And then it's that last shot of him where he saved that little girl from the debris falling on her. And she says, oh, my mum's up in that building. My mum's not coming back.
Yeah.
And then he looks up and sees Superman and Zod falling back from outer space as they're about to fall into Metropolis Station. And the look of pure hatred on his face as he literally glares up
at
Superman and Zod. You wonder if that was the switch, because there's Alfred even seems to be relative when he first goes back to the Batcave and Alfred's talking to Alfred's trying to fix the voice modulator.
Mm.
Alfred like shows him the newspaper of the guy being branded or sort of some the criminal being branded from the sex traffic women.
Yeah, and
he says something like, "Oh, is this what we're doing now? Is this a new way of doing it?" So you wonder if it's that 18 months since where
it sort of tipped him over the line a little bit,
because the whole game's changed, doesn't it?
Yeah,
the whole game's changed now.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a really good point. I think that you're right. I do think that's a factor. There probably is that frustration and stuff that had been building, and then just to see that, like, oh, now these two metahumans can just decimate a city and you know, hundreds if not thousands of lives are sort of like lost or at least impacted. Yeah, there's that kind of thing of like, you know, right, well, you know, just what I think it is that thing, what chance have I got? I've got to be more hardline to you know, yeah, to make an impact, I suppose. So you're right, and I do like that scene, and that, 'cause that's the scene when they said Bruce says back to him, like, you know, we've always been criminals. This is always what it's been about.
Mm. And there's that wonderful line Alfred comes back with, isn't he, where he says, "This is how it starts: the feeling of the rage, the feeling of powerlessness that turns good men cruel." And that's exactly what's happened here. Mm. He is a good man. Bruce Wayne is a good man, but he has literally turned cruel. He's still fighting criminals the way he always has, but his methods have become more violent and nastier.
Yeah, so, there's a bitterness to it. But you're right in being a good guy, because one of the things that sort of, as part of the plot, you do, in that early scene, there is the guy who has fallen and the girder has sort of fallen on him you know, he ends up losing his legs. And you do find out that Bruce Wayne has, you know, hasn't fired him, which probably would have happened in most American companies, but has made sure that he remains employed and has given him another job. And you know, he is looking out for, or trying to look out for the people in his organization. So you're right, he is that sort of, he's trying to be a good man. So yeah, no, I do like that sort of approach that they have. The thing with this is, I think things like that are good. I think, because I think the reason I sort of I'm on board with the Batfleck being this way is because you see that there's a baggage, because you get to see the Robin costume with the graffiti. You know, as you say, you sort of see the sort of the progressive cruelty that sort of has clearly come in. Doesn't really explain the turn at the end, which I'm trying to hold off on for now, but we'll get. Because there's other characters I want to sort of touch on before we get to that point. So the other key character in all this is Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, so far we've had a kind of staple of what Luthor is. He's a bit comedic, a bit sort of silly, but like on screen he's been, you know, dangerous or whatever, criminal mastermind. But like they obviously went with a tech bro kind of approach. You know, choosing Jesse Eisenberg, who had you know, already played Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Clearly, you know, not saying I'm not going to suggest anything, but it's kind of there. What are your thoughts on this take on Batman and his performance? Or this take on Lex Luthor, sorry.
On Lex Luthor, yeah. There's things I like about it, and there's things I think are just so away from what the character normally is. Mm. I mean, I'm not one of these people who's like thinks characters are sacrosanct and you just cannot deviate ever so slightly from what they've been for, you know, in the case of Lex Luthor, you know, decades upon decades. And you're completely right what you're saying. I think they are trying to channel that Zuckerberg tech billionaire kind of, you know, dare I say a smattering of Elon Musk in there as well. Mm. But to me, I think his performance is good in terms of what he's been given to do, and I think he executes it very well. But I think in some ways, it seems like he's playing the Riddler more than he's playing Lex Luthor. Not so much in what he does, but in his mannerisms. His Lex Luthor is constantly twitching, and you know, it's like he's got kind of Tourette's in a way without the verbal side of it. He's got those tics all the time and twitches, and he'll say something and then go like halfway through speaking, and it's a really, you know, affected performance. Lex Luthor's always traditionally anyway been cool, calculating, calm, the smartest man in any room. I mean, you know, in this iteration, he's incredibly smart to sort of mastermind this plan, and to manipulate, you know, Batman and Superman in the way he does. So obviously he's a genius level character, and it is portrayed as such. But it's just a very weird performance. You know, there's, again, they talk about backstory with Batman. There's backstory here. He refers more than once to his father, who's died by this point, and how he was an abusive man. He says something about, you know, no one saved me from daddy's fists and abominations. Yeah. I think the line is, and God knows what he means by abominations. The mind boggles as to what that could be. So he's clearly a very, very damaged individual. But it's a very bold take. I get why people don't like it, because it's radically different. But I do quite enjoy it for what it is. I think Jesse Eisenberg is a good actor, and I think he portrays it well. I just think it's for some people, it's probably a little bit too much of a leap from what you're expecting and what it looks like we're going to be getting in the upcoming interpretation. Nicholas Holt seems like a return to what people might expect from Luther. I mean, what do you think? Do you like Eisenberg in this and what he brings to it?
I almost appreciate that they went for something different. You know, you're going to try for something, you might as well go, you know, swing for the fences.
Yeah.
I think the problem with it is I'm not the biggest fan of Jesse Eisenberg. I think, you know, when he's doing his nerdy thing, well, I like, you know, Zombieland, you know, is great.
Yeah.
So what he can do in those kinds of things, and he, you know, there's other films that have sort of played on it. And I think the problem I sort of have with it here is he's just sort of, I never sort of see, I get the idea they're going, you know, this is the whole thing of like brains versus brawn, isn't it? That's the idea. And they want to sort of show that, you know, he keeps chopping and changing the way he talks, because during that speech he does, like the benefits for the library and stuff. And he says, you know, no speech, bars open, and then laughs it off, and then says, no, and then starts making this rambling speech. And they're trying to show that, like, his brain is working so fast that even he can't almost keep up with it. Like, you know, thoughts keep popping into his head. But the one thing is that it doesn't show, it doesn't, it's not a performance that has that restraint that I sort of, like a sophisticated restraint that you, as you sort of said, of Lex Luthor. It's always been that kind of thing of, he's not just the smartest man in the room. He's kind of like, he knows he's the smartest man in the room, and then therefore is able to sort of, like, you know, it's a bit like, we've said, like, you know, Batman will walk in because he knows he can deck anyone, but like, Lex is able to read everyone or knows everything. And this performance is just so manic at times. It just feels kind of, you know, it feels like a performance. I think that's the problem. As you said, it's full of affects, isn't it? It's sort of full of affectations, that it feels like a performance. The scene where he's putting the Jolly Rancher into that sort of senator's mouth and stuff is kind of so weird. You're just sort of like, the dude would just go, no. No. Like, piss off and, like, bat it away. It just feels like, it constantly feels like he's gone, oh, I've got to be weird, so I'm going to sort of stand there like Mr. Burns, or I'm going to be doing things with my hands. Everything feels like he's thinking through a performance. And so after a while, I'm kind of just like, yeah, I get it. I get it. You know, you're playing the weirdo.
Oh, very much so. It's like something that should be on the stage rather than on the screen. You know,
it's
bigger than life. Now, I know we're living in, it is a comic book film. You know, he's a supervillain. The whole concept of the film is bigger than life. But the whole point of Man of Steel and the Snyderverse, for if that term still exists, is that it was supposed to be grounded in reality, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Man of Steel was supposed to be, this is what would happen if Superman suddenly came to our world. This is, we're going to do it like a real world take. It's not a heightened reality. We're just going to present the world as it is, but this is what would happen if a superpowered alien suddenly showed up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they continue in that tone with this, but then you bring in this character who's very pantomimey and extravagant, and you know, it kind of, it takes you, if he'd have been a very, not monotone, but a very sort of contained Lex Luthor, a very sort of, not laid back, that's the wrong word, but very self-secure, rather than erratic and all over the place, I think it might have suited the vibe more. I just think I think he really stands out. Again, like I said, I quite enjoy his performance. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. And when he's on screen, he's entertaining, if nothing else. But it is a very unusual take on the character, and I completely get why people really do not like his version.
Yeah. It's a little grating. I think that's part of the problem. It grates on me after all. I mean, I think part of it is, what do you think as a viewer that he knows, if you know what I mean? So by the end of the film, it's quite clever in that respect, that by the end of the film, you look back at scenes and you go like, oh, like that scene now means something completely different. So, because by the end of the film, you realise that he knows exactly that Bruce Wayne is Batman and that Clark Kent is Superman. And so, you know, the scene again at the benefit where he sort of introduces and he sort of says, you know, Clark Kent, Bruce Wayne, you know, here's me bringing people together. And that whole thing of like, you know, do not pick a fight with this guy, kind of like, you know, it's clear that, oh, he knows what he is saying. And so, yeah, I don't know. It just, and there's hints of like, you know, when he says to Bruce, you should really come see our R&D department. We should work on, you know, collaborate on something together. And I think at that point, I wonder if he's sort of, he's obviously suggesting, because he sort of says he's set up the kryptonite, because he's like, well, I've created the weapon, but I can't wield the weapon, so I'm going to make sure that Batman can get at it. That's the whole point.
He wants him to steal it, doesn't he?
He wants him to steal it, yeah. He says, like, I gave him the weapon. Yeah. And that's the point where I think, you know, he's saying, like, oh, what we can collab, you know, you should see some of the wild things I'm doing in the R&D department.
Mm.
You know, we should work on something together. And it's like, you know, it's... But to me, I'm watching that going, there's not enough, like, sarcasm in that performance to be like, you know, I know things that you don't know, kind of thing. Yeah, it's almost like not, I don't know, it's sort of heightened camp, but slightly not camp enough in certain areas. It's kind of, yeah, weirdly inconsistent.
I think, like you said, when you understand at the end and you're watching the whole film through the prism of knowing his plan all along, certain things do make more sense. That scene when he arrives on the motorbike at LexCorp and sees that Batman has been there and nicked his whole stash of kryptonite and left the batarang behind, he breaks into a smile, a half smile, doesn't he?
Yes.
And at the time you're thinking, oh, he's a bit weird or whatever. But then when you watch it, knowing what comes, you understand that that was exactly what he wanted to happen. And up until Martha, everything that happens in that film is exactly how and what he wants to happen.
Yes.
Everything plays out exactly as he wants. The manipulation of both sides, you know, everything that happens with the court and Holly Hunter's Senator Finch, June Finch, I think she's called. Everything. It's so well planned out. He just didn't count on the human factor, which is, you know, the most divisive part of the film, I guess. But up to that point, though, everything is just played out exactly to his specification. His master plan, his sort of puppet mastery. He's delivered it to a T, really.
Yeah, and I think that's that kind of I think my problem with it is I like the fact that he's there acting as this sort of like the behind the scenes puppet master, and these things have been tweaked here and tweaked there to set up this confrontation.
Yeah.
And as you say, up until the Martha thing, it kind of all plays out as he wants. I do think it's a little bit of a shame that the end, towards the end of the film, when it's kind of like he's set Batman up to be this kind of like, you know, he's almost antagonized Batman. He's sort of provided him, you know, I think I'm, you know, I'm not sure if he's let him have that, the information about the metahumans and all that kind of stuff. But he's set it up so he can steal the kryptonite and forge it into that spear.
Yeah.
And the grenades and stuff. And so all that's like this master manipulation. And then for Superman, it's like, yeah, I'm going to kidnap his mum and, you know, and then I'm going to kidnap Lois Lane to bring him to this situation. And you think for all this master manipulation, at the end of the day, like, all he does is kidnap a couple of women in order to manipulate Superman.
Yeah.
You know, I think, like, kind of feels cheap after everything else has gone on. Like, oh, that's... That seems really kind of like base, and like you've worked so hard across all this other stuff, and now at the end of the day, it's like I have these pictures of your mother all tied up, and you're like, you're like, yeah, this kind of feels, I don't know, just silly compared to some of the other like machinations that have gone on.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like everything he's done was, I guess, was to sow the seeds of distrust and turn public perception against Superman.
Yeah.
Because he hates him. I mean, he says something like, I don't hate the sinner, I hate the sin, I think he says. And
yeah, and you have the sin of existence, and you go...
Yeah.
This is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you get the feeling he's not bothered about Bruce Wayne as Batman per se. It's Superman that he wants out of the picture. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's using Batman as a means to get it done because he thinks Batman can physically best him, which turns out to be true. So I guess everything he's done is about perception and about obviously winding Bruce Wayne up like a coiled spring as well, and giving him the fuel to go for it, to fight. But yeah, I know what you mean. It's like, yeah, I've kidnapped your missus, I've kidnapped your mum.
Yeah.
What are you going to do about it? But it is a very cool scene, actually, when he brings Superman comes to him, and Superman says, I'm going to break you in a minute, or I'll take you in without breaking you. And he literally brings Superman to his knees by showing him a stack of Polaroid pictures. That's it.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to resort to any physicality or kryptonite rays, or you know, unleashes a version of Doomsday which comes later. Literally, he brings a god to his knees, and it's a very striking image that I think, you know, it just shows that a very physically meek character, obviously a mental giant, but a physically meek character can bring a physical god character to their literal knees. I just really like that imagery, but like you said, it's just delivered in such a like kind of ham-fisted way, like got your mom.
Yeah, exactly. No, it is. That's a real shame. So I just think, like you say, it's one of those, like, I appreciate the variance, the difference they've gone for the character. So well done for going different, because they could have gone, you know, very similar or in a similar route, but they went for something different, and I'm fine with, as you say, I'm not sort of like, there's no single character that I'm attached to enough where I'm going to go like, no, I want no differences. Like, you know, because performances differ and you know, it can still make for a great film. So I think all that's fine. It does kind of sort of like, it's the thing I'd say for Amy Adams is this end part. It kind of, she's the one that unravels this mystery. So you see her as being a great investigative reporter, and she does all this stuff. And I like the fact that she continues to be, has agency, and she sort of, you know, is a good at her job, you know?
Yeah.
And unfortunately at the end of the film, she's kind of boils down to, you know, damsel in distress a little bit.
Being thrown off the building.
So that's a little sad that that's sort of there, but At least they she's not just there as a damsel in distress. She is a she has other purposes.
She uncovers it before
Oh, absolutely,
anyone else. Before, Batman's supposed to be the world's greatest detective, and he hasn't got a clue what's going on.
No.
He's so blinded by rage and his obsession. Yes. His obsession. He doesn't see the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Because there's one thing, I don't know if you feel the same about this, right? But so obviously Luther knows Clark Kent is Superman.
Mm-hmm.
So when Bruce Wayne decides, right, I'm going to get Superman. Bruce Wayne has unlimited resources and he is the world's greatest detective. Why hasn't he figured out that Clark Kent is Superman to the point where it would render the, why did you say the name Martha, completely moot, because he would already know that Martha Kent is Superman's adoptive mother, I should say.
Yeah.
I always found that a bit strange that he never figured out Clark Kent and Superman were.
Have you ever seen the Justice League Unlimited episode where it shows Batman and Superman meeting for the first time? And
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
So it's Justice League Unlimited with the cartoon from the sort of late 90s, early 2000s. And in it, they sort of meet, and Superman just uses his X-ray vision to see through the cowl. And so it goes, he's like, Bruce Wayne. And then it's sort of, he says, similar to this, he sort of says, not so much stop what you're doing, but, better know who you are. And then when Superman goes home and he is Clark and he's off to bed, and he basically gets a phone call and Batman's like, I know who you are. Da, da, da. And he just put a tracking device on him, followed it. And then he's just like, I've just followed you and watched you do these things. And you're like, that's what Batman would do. Like, you're right. He would figure it out. Like, so you're right. I think he's blinded by his rage, but it's kind of disappointing, this whole.
Yeah.
We'll get to them. I'm holding off on the Martha thing for just.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, and on the flip side of the coin, you think, why wouldn't Superman knows Bruce Wayne is Batman. He finds out at the point in the film where they're at the aforementioned Luther fundraising gala, and they're both there, and he hears through Bruce's earpiece, Alfred on the earpiece to him, telling him where to go to copy Luther's hard drive. So, although he might not specifically know he's Batman, but he knows.
He kind of figures it out. And
He knows he's up to something. He's not a mere billionaire playboy, is he? And obviously, that conversation that they have where he says, what's your opinion on the Batman in Gotham? There's a little bit of spice to that where you think he's, perhaps he knows.
You may recognize. We know we've had problems with clown of people dressing up like clowns in Gotham City. So yeah.
So at that point, you think, oh, does he know Clark Kent's Superman? Mm. But clearly, he doesn't. But I've just always, again, you think, why doesn't Superman, if he knows Bruce Wayne is Batman, why doesn't he go to him before? Long before the finale of the film, turn up not as Clark Kent, turn up in full costume as Superman.
Yeah,
at Wayne Manor, or not Wayne Manor, that's burnt out, but that sort of glass house he's living at by the lake, or even turn up at Wayne Enterprises one day and say, "Look, can we talk in private, you and I?" And then just say, "Like, I know, something like that." But again, I suppose it would.
Well, this
risking too much, aren't we? Yeah.
No, yeah, but then this is part of the other. Just again, to go to this point, Clark gets as Clark Kent, as journalist of the Planet, he gets a little bit up in arms about this, the Batman in Gotham City. Now we know it's said he's been around for around 20 years, right? And Clark's been living in Metropolis for like two. So, one thing that annoys me about this is the fact that he thinks he's onto something, and even Perry calls him out. It's like Gotham, has crime. In other news, water is wet. It's obvious that Gotham is the sort of the more criminal based problem. I also have a problem with them being across the bay. Like, that really kind of bothers me, by the way, as well. But that's minor niggle. This thing of him then taking it upon himself as Superman to just turn up and sort of the Batmobile crashes into him when he's driving away, and he's sort of then he tells Batman the Batman's done bury it. Yeah. Like, you know, yeah. whenever the light symbol goes on again. At no point, we're saying he's got cruel and he's got angry and frustrated and he's doing this branding. Mm. But at no point does anyone say, yeah, but over the 20 years, he's actually done, like, all this good stuff. Like, you know, here's yeah. here's the sort of the net benefit of having Batman in Gotham. He unearthed all this corruption in there. There's, you know, more people would have died from the Joker or Penguin or Two-Face or whoever if he hadn't been around. Like, there's no looking at the history. Clark just goes off, seeing what you're doing now, I don't like it. No one, there's no sort of looking at his history or discussion about the history of Batman being in Gotham. He's been there for 2 decades. It's a lot of time. Like, I don't know, it just feels kind yeah. of short-sighted for Clark to do that. And you should be like, you know, I've seen what you did in the past. You're on this dark path. I want you to change. Like, you yeah. did good.
I completely agree. Yeah, again, it's just little things that don't stack up because yeah. we can see this isn't a Batman who, like you said, it's 20 years. He hasn't just sprouted up out of nowhere. And, you know, this is a Batman with a bat signal. This is somebody yeah. who obviously does collaborate with the Gotham City Police Department. He's not, you know, completely out on his own. I mean, obviously, it's not relevant because we're jumping ahead to the next one. But in Justice League with, you know, J.K. Simmons as Commissioner Gordon, he has the bat signal up there. Then he, you know, when someone hands him a sketch of a parademon and someone thinks, does that look like someone you know? And he goes, well, do you really think after 20 years of doing good, he'd start doing this? I don't think yeah. so. So again, he's had 20 years of being Batman and Batman defeats supervillains. That's what he does. So yeah, you would think there would be an element of that. So yeah, again, it's just like, why are you... Granted, you wouldn't necessarily have heard of him because you've been... you grew up in Smallville and then prior to the events of Man of Steel, you were sort of wandering the world, trying to find your place in it and trying to, you know, come to terms with, you know, find out about your heritage and that. And I was like, so you might not have had your ear to the ground of what's been going on in just in Gotham City. But yeah, surely it would come up in conversation, you know.
Well, the Daily Planet is a Metropolis newspaper, but if it's across the bay, I'm pretty sure he could simply ask Lois. She's been a journalist for a long time and she's very good at her job. I'm pretty sure she'd be like, oh, no, I have a file on the Batman and here's, you know, 2 decades worth of information. Like, yeah, it's never explored. It's never kind of, you know.
Yeah, they treat Batman like an urban myth, don't they?
Yeah.
That people don't seem to be quite sure if he exists, which, again, is like, come on.
I've seen the car wrecking lorries. Yeah, you know, yeah. that's not an urban myth. That's someone's picking up that rubble and you know, debris. So, yeah.
Again, it's just, you can pick so many holes out of the plot and narrative for this film. It's untrue.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop me from really liking it. There are so many things that just don't quite stack up. Yeah,
it's that weird thing of, and again, it's sort of swinging for the fences, which I always appreciate. So it's not bad. It's more the fact that it does just feel like just sort of several degrees off the characters that I would expect. Mm. And so you go, like, oh, so that just seems unusual behaviour for what I'm used to seeing from that character. Mm. But on the other side, as is often the case with Zack Snyder, you know, sometimes the characters are off and the story is not exactly, you know, the most sensible. But I would say, I'm not going to lie, this film looks amazing. As you sort of said, like, his greatest talent is screening just framing a shot and, you know, picking the right things. There's some fantastic, even like the simple stuff, as you said, like the beginning, that the image of Bruce Wayne running into that cloud, and when he gets through the horse that sort of like staggers past and all that sort of thing. It just looks, this film looks ace, and there's some really cool stuff in it. And when the fighting starts, it's choreographed very well. Brutal as hell. So, you know, I am on I'm on the ride. I'm sort of on board with it. It's just, but there is that constant niggle at the back of my head saying, like, Yes, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Of course I do. Yeah, I mean, you know, people can love Zack Snyder, they can hate Zack Snyder, they can couldn't care less about Zack Snyder. Excuse me, but one thing he excuse me again, but one thing he does do very well, like you said, is visuals. Kind of like Michael Bay in a way. You know, Michael Bay, again, you can love his films, you can hate them, you can think they're terrible, but he does have a flair for the visual and for framing action and for great camera work and things like that. So, it does look great. And it works really well on a visual level in collaboration. Again, I think we talked about it last time with Man of Steel, but it works really well with the score again.
Yes.
Bringing Hans Zimmer back to reprise his role from Man of Steel, but I think it's a guy called Junkie XL, I think he's called, who worked on this one with him. Mm. Again, the music is so good. There's like an operatic quality to this film.
Yes.
I think that ties into the film taking itself very, very seriously and being very, very, I guess, dour, for want of a better word. But it has that operatic quality, even like, again, jumping way ahead to the end, but when Superman meets his untimely end, there's a hugely dramatic swell of music, isn't there? And it's, you know, all done in with such grandiosity and what have you. He's definitely trying to create something that's, again, it's that dichotomy, because it's trying to be something that's indicative of the real world.
Yeah.
But there's a... Yeah, I think operatic is almost a word for it. Yeah.
I think, I agree. I think, it's that there's an elevation to what they're trying to do. I do think the score and the music in it. I mean, Junkie XL has gone on to do quite a bit. He did Mad Max Fury Road. Mm. He was involved in the Deadpool film. So, yeah, he's done some pretty cool scores. And the combination of that kind of style works really well. Okay, before we get, because we are going to get to the end, I'm waiting on another character before we get to the end, because it is Batman v Superman. And so, you know, the third of the Trinity, I'm just going to wait for the next sort of bit. But let's get to that fight. So you do have the final fight, as it's sort of like, you know, Batman's dressed in his Dark Knight Returns metal outfit. And he's got all these things set up, and he's got his kryptonite grenades and all those kinds of things, and the spear. And the fight between them is pretty good. Mm. I've got to say, it's well done. It's kind of, it's solid, but there is it becomes a fight, and I'm quite happy. I get Batman's motivation. We've been shown for almost 2.5 hours Batman's motivation as to why he wants to do this fight. And so I understand why he's relentless in this fight.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still going to hold it. The fight is great and everything. It still works. Mm-hmm. But like, as you said, Superman attempts to talk to Bruce once. And then he's just like, all right, I'll just pop his head off and be done with it. It's kind of like, you know, he could, when he gets his strength back at one point, he could easily just sort of stop him, hold him and talk and be like, listen, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So that's fine. But let's get to the Martha. Let's get to the Martha piece.
Here we go.
So he pins him down. Batman sort of almost defeats Superman. He's got the kryptonite spear. He's won. Yeah. I like the design. I like the fact he cuts his face and he's trying to sort of prove to him, you know, how, you know, I like there's a whole thing where he says about being brave. He says, you're not brave because you're invulnerable. Mm. Like, you know, firefighters are brave. Like, people are brave because I like and all that stuff. Yeah. So he gets his point and then he's just sort of saying, he says, was it sort of stop Luther, save Martha, something like that. And then he says, why'd you say that name? Why'd you say that name? And he sort of says, save Martha a few times. And I am going sort of like, I can't help it. I remember watching this in the cinema and laughing at it then and being like, this is ridiculous. Yes, they have a mother with the same name. But Bruce knows that his mother has been dead for 40 years. All right? If not 30, 35 years.
Yeah, it's not 30 something, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So why is he like, why'd you say that name? It's not gonna be like, it's not your mum, mate. He's not talking about Martha Wayne.
Mm.
So this whole turn here, when all of a sudden there's this realization and Lois runs in and she's like, it's his mother's name, it's his mum's name. And like,
good job she was there, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I'd still be like, so? Like, how do I don't understand, and I've never understood, and I know some people try to explain it to me, but there is this thing of like, Batman all of a sudden goes like, oh, you have a mum? I have a mum? Then we must be friends.
Mm.
And I'm like, no, you've based this whole pad to all, you know, 18 months of resentment and obsession building up to this because you know that this guy could level a city at any point.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
Yeah. I know what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
But they do it in such a heavy-handed, badly executed, badly written way.
Yeah.
Again, I love this film very much, but this scene is terribly executed. So I get what they're trying to do. So basically, Batman has lost his way. He's lost his humanity, for want of a better word. He's so driven by hatred and vengeance and cruelty that he's going to basically execute Superman. You know, he's not there to beat him in a fight. He's won the fight. Superman's down. He's basically going to finish him with the spear and end his life. And he's kind of lost his, like I say, he's lost his humanity. And it's that thing that reminds him, because Superman's mum has the same name, therefore Superman must have a mother on Earth. So it kind of shows him that Superman has a humanity. I think that's trying to go for.
He sees
Superman as an alien being, which he is, of course,
mm-hmm.
but he sees him as purely an alien being who potentially could end the entire world, and therefore that's what he has. He does that line. He says, if there's even a 1% chance that he's going to do this, we have to take it as an absolute certainty, I think. So, you know, he says, there's another line where he says, I'm older now than my father ever was, and this might be the only thing I ever do that means anything. So it's everything to him, and he that's how he sees Superman. He doesn't see him as anything other than an alien wannabe deity. And it's that thing of him saying, save my mum, please. If you're going to kill me, that's okay, but please save my mum. And I guess, again, it's so stupid, but that's what they're trying to do. It makes Batman see that this guy who's under his boot heel, who he's about to kill, who he sees as an alien, actually has a human life and people who love him and a family that care for him and a mother that's going to miss her son terribly if he kills him.
So
that brings him back from the edge, but it's so stupid, yeah.
So that guy that he branded at the beginning of the film, if he'd have gone, I've got kids.
Yeah.
Batman would have gone, oh, okay, I'm sorry. Like,
I know. There's no consistency, is there?
No, it's the thing is, I think, I know I do this. I was thinking about this after watching this yesterday. I was watching it and I was thinking, how do you improve it? If this went through another couple of drafts, how do you improve it? And I kind of realised that, like, the mum is the problem. It being Martha Kent is the problem. Because I know why they're trying to do it and they're trying to lead to this point, but it's so silly. I feel like she should be left out of it, because what it also does, it kind of makes Superman, not selfish, but like, he's trading one life for another, is what he's sort of suggesting. My mother is worth more in the world than Bruce Wayne's, right? And, you know, I'm not here to debate either or, but that's the point. That's the level. And Superman has been, and that's kind of what Luthor's hoping for. He kills Batman because it's a win-win situation. Either Batman kills Superman and Luthor wins, or Superman kills Batman and brings him the head of what's it. And then Luthor can be like, oh my God, this is what Superman's done. He's starting just popping people's heads off left, right, and center. Like, he's dangerous. Like, he can have him, you know, he wins either way.
Mm.
But this whole thing with the mother, like, I was thinking, if Luther was like almost like, you know, I thought about kidnapping your mother, but I'm not a monster, so I've kidnapped 12 children. Just 12 random kids, you know. Mm. You don't know who they are, doesn't matter, but I'm going to kill 12 random kids. And if it was like, you know, it's to remove the personal connection, and that would, to me, would actually show more humanity, where Superman was like, look, the boot heel of Batman been saying like, look, if you're going to kill me, fine, but you've got to save those kids.
Mm.
Whatever you do, stop Luther and save those kids, I think would be more, mean more than like, you know, save my mom.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. They make it, they boil it down to something very, very simple. And it's, yeah, considering the stakes, it's literally just a case of I want to save my mother. Not I want to stop Luther from what he's about to do, which we've not talked about yet, with the logic behind Luther creating Doomsday as well.
Yeah.
What he hopes to bring from that. So you do wonder what would have happened if it hadn't ended and Batman had killed him. What would have come next? Because he at this point, he's already created Doomsday, hasn't he? Mm. Doomsday. So Doomsday is going to hatch no matter what. And Doomsday is an unstoppable monster that literally can't be stopped. And the only person on Earth, in theory, who could stop him is Superman, because he's a Kryptonian. Doomsday is part Kryptonian in this iteration. I wonder what was Luther's motivation for creating Doomsday. Was it because he thinks Superman will kill Batman, and therefore Doomsday will kill? Is it insurance? But then what happens if Superman's dead? Who's, you know, I don't understand.
Well, no, I don't. And this is, so he refers to it as an anti-Kryptonian weapon is how he refers to this, what he's doing. But it's also really arbitrary. So he takes General Zod's body and feeds it into the genetic machine and then adds the birthing sort of, you know, whatever of the ship, and then adds his own DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, it's going to create this, you know, it's going to create. And the ship itself says, like, you know, this creating this monstrosity has been banned. And I'm doing, what is it that you're expecting to happen from this? All you do is mix two things of DNA. Why does it come out in this massive, mindless killing machine? When like does that mean? I was thinking, like, what you doing is that, like, you've shared Kryptonian and human DNA, right? Doomsday is the result in this, with one of the most clunky name drops ever. But does that mean that, like, if Lois and Superman and Clark had got together and ended up having children, like, would they have given birth to something like this kind of monstrosity? Because that's what you're saying, that the combination of this DNA becomes this monster. I don't know. But from an insurance point of view, you're right. It doesn't work because, I think here's how it played out in my head, and this could be complete headcanon. Superman kills Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And so Superman is then shown to be this killer, which you've already seen, but like, now killing people, popping their heads off. So Lex can now release this Kryptonian weapon against Superman. Mm-hmm. It kills Superman, and then Lex would be the one using the Kryptonian or the Kryptonite weapons to bring down Doomsday, and he becomes the hero of the day.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But as you say, I see nothing for the second two parts of the plan in any way prepared. So yeah, he kind of just releases Doomsday.
I know. Yeah, I don't understand why he's doing that, unless it is purely he thinks Superman will win. But then you think, well, what was the point anyway of pitting him against Batman if you think he's going to win anyway, and therefore you're going to have to sick your monster on him? It renders the whole Batman versus Superman fight almost redundant if you think that's what's going to happen, which absolutely doesn't happen. It doesn't quite make sense. But I mean, you know, obviously it's an excuse for a lot of cool action. I mean, for a film that it takes such a long time to get there, there's, like you said, it's like well over 2 hours before we get to this final act. And, you know, you do see people saying, oh, this film could have done with an extra action sequence in there during the course of the film. And I get that, because it is quite a slow build, isn't it? For a comic book based blockbuster, which this was, it does sort of not have the usual amount of action in it throughout that one would expect, wouldn't you? You would expect to see more than you get. I mean, Superman, other than the start where he plows the African guy through a wall, and other than that, he does the bit where he stands there and lets the Batmobile bounce off him. he doesn't really do anything until we get to the final act, where it's just, you know, it's non-stop action for 30 or 40 minutes with everything you could imagine in there. It's a very slow build to this point. I'm on the fence about whether it needed something in there a bit more, you know, just showing Superman doing something amazing or even another Batman sequence in there as well, you know?
So I would lean into the Superman. I think it needs another Superman doing something heroic.
Yeah. Something amazing, like, you know, stopping an erupting volcano or...
Yeah. Well, you get the montages. Yeah. You get all these montage-y bits of it, but it's not... It's all very sort of like, here's a snippet, here's a snippet, here's a snippet. Like, you need to have the full scene to see him doing those, you know, saving people and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, power plant on fire, Superman 3 style. That's what I want. So,
like a variation of the oil rig sequence from the very first film, or something like that.
No, exactly. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, it that last 34 minutes, you know, it's Batman versus Superman. It's Batman at the warehouse taking on 22 dozen heavily armed mercenaries.
Yeah.
It's Superman versus Doomsday, with ending with them getting nuked in outer space. It's Batman turning up to fight Doomsday. It's someone else turning up to fight Doomsday. It's the three of them fighting Doomsday.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's kitchen sink time. It's as terms of like bang for your buck. That last act is great, you know.
It is. Oh no, again, it pays off really well. And this is one of those things, again, like, I think, you know, it does the visuals well, and Superman fighting Doomsday and him punching him up into the sky and then into space and all that sort of stuff. Looks good. I think it all looks kind of cool. And they fire the nuclear weapons, and what do they call them? I forgot they have a code name for them, 1 and 2.
I can't remember, but when they're on the phone to the president.
Yeah. And then one of them's fallen back to Earth and the other one's sort of floating in space, and it's sort of like, you know, the one in space is Superman.
Yeah.
The one that's fallen to Earth is you know, Doomsday. And then the bit where he sort of starts to just shed his skin and all the, you know, the bone fragments are all coming out. It's I remember when this came out and they showed like an image of it. It was the bit where he sort of first comes out and he looks like a troll from like The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, just when he's about to heat vision Batman, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. By the end of their fight him, he's got the bone spurs and he's got this. He does look kind of cool. I mean, it's a pretty cool looking monster.
Yeah.
But the way that they've layered this scene is good. As you say, you've got the two different battles going on, and then Batman makes the decision to go back and sort of help Superman and take on, get him back to the city, because we've got to get back to the dock where we can have the fight, because that's where the kryptonite is. So that's all cool. Now, let's talk about the introduction of Wonder Woman, because she does actually get of all the hero introductions in this film, I think hers is the most badass.
Oh, it's brilliant! Yeah,
it is. Batman's pinned down, and you do get Doomsday sort of running towards him, and you do get Bruce just going like, "Oh shit!"
Yeah, I'm dead, basically.
Yeah. He fires the heat vision, and all of a sudden, like, you know, he's not hit. And it's the first time that they use her theme. And it's a cracking theme. Because, I think next to some of these, I think the Wonder Woman, the first Wonder Woman film, is a corker and is absolutely...
I love that film, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, top notch. But the music in it is great, and so I love this moment where she sort of like shows, you know, her bands are sort of like, you know, wristbands that sort of pulls them down, and she's sort of been protecting against this heat vision.
Mm.
And so you've been seeing Diana Prince throughout the film, Gal Gadot,
yeah,
looking very attractive, and you know, but maybe being very demure throughout the whole film, and then to see her sort of in this Wonder Woman garb is, they do it really well, like, you know. So it's a good intro. She looks great and everything. And it leads to probably the only, possibly, but the best joke of the film.
Mm.
When Superman turns up and he's like, she with you? And Batman's like, I thought she was with you.
Yeah, because, yeah, Superman has never even met her at that point. Obviously, her and Bruce Wayne have had a couple of interactions before, yeah, haven't they? But he literally is like, who the hell is this?
Yeah. So that's kind of cool. It's fun. And then he goes into the fighting and stuff. So now I think introducing Wonder Woman in this way is sort of like drip feeding her throughout the film. And then the big reveal at the end is really well done.
Mm. Oh, I agree. I think it's as a backdoor way of introducing that character into this universe. It's really well executed, because you get, you know, obviously her film, standalone mm. film, was to come
a year or so
after this, the following year, I think, the first one.
Mm.
But this is a way of introducing her, and they do it really well in that, we all knew she was in it because she was all over the trailer, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, there was an official shot of her, like a press photo of her in all the regalia as well. Mm. So it wasn't like an Easter egg moment where she drops down out of nowhere and you're like, my God, it's Wonder Woman, oh my God. So everyone knew she was in the film. It wasn't a surprise, but in any way, shape or form. But it doesn't detract from how impactful her introduction as Wonder Woman is. Just not as her as Diana Prince at the fundraiser and at the museum. And then the bits on the, where she decides to step up and get off the plane and that.
Yeah.
Dropping in seemingly out of nowhere in full on classic Wonder Woman costume with the sword, with the shield, is absolutely triumphant. It works so well with that music. It's a great way of introducing it. And they also do a really good job of introducing little snippets of the mythos of Wonder Woman as well.
Yeah.
Which we completely forgot to talk about, actually, which is a really bizarre moment in the film. The introduction of Luther's files, where he's collected all these this metahuman database, he's compiled, hasn't he? Where he's got this 100-year-old picture of Wonder Woman from World War One, which lets the audience know she's been around for a long time. She's an immortal. But then he also has these snippets of footage that he somehow got of Barry Allen, of Arthur Curry Aquaman, and of the formation of Cyborg, of Victor Stone. But he's also somehow managed also to create their logos. Yeah, Lex Luthor's the genius branding man who creates the Flash and Aquaman and Cyborg logos.
That's it. He popped off to Canva after he got those videos, made the logos, and was like, oh, I like that. I like giving people logos. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a tease for what's to come, and it's showing that these, you know, wow, the Flash exists in this universe. So does Aquaman. Brilliant. And we'll get to see them in the future. So people are like, oh, it's a really shitty way to introduce those characters. A bit of CCTV footage. But you're not really, their big introduction comes in Justice League.
Yes.
And, you know,
I guess a little bit in this one, in Barry's a little bit in this one, but
that's what I was just about to get to. So we get, while he's waiting for this file to decrypt that he's nicked from Luther, he has this vision of this apocalyptic future where Superman has turned evil and has subjugated the Earth, and we're under an invasion by the army of Apocalypse, because we see parademons in this future, and the Omega sign on the ground. And then he's awoken by a time-traveling Barry Allen. To someone who's not perhaps into the lore and understanding of like apocalypse and all that, you would probably watch that and think, what the hell have I just seen.
Yes.
And there's no explanation as to how, why does Bruce Wayne have visions of the future? There's no, there's absolutely no reason for Bruce Wayne to be able to see the future. And then he sees, and then he sees Barry, but Barry's not there, because again, that was a vision of the future, because Barry is going to visit him in a future film during the events of, I guess, what would have been Justice League 2 if we mm-hmm. lived in a parallel universe and everything well, that happened didn't happen happened.
Well, did so, it? I'm really confused by some of this, because the future thing of what do they call him? Like, you know, the Dark Knight Batman,
the nightmare, yeah,
the nightmare Batman, yeah,
yeah.
So he has this vision, but like you said, there's nothing there that sort of jolted this, because, yeah, how does he know about parademons and all this other stuff? It's weird. He looks cool. Good design again. Cool. Mm. The trench coat.
And everything. Oh, I love the scene, yeah. But it makes no sense.
It makes no sense. But the thing is, when Barry turns up and he sort of says, you know, you were right. Lois Lane, she's the key to the... And then Barry says, I'm too early. Find us, Bruce, find us.
Mm.
And I'm like, no, that can't be a dream. That has to be a real moment in order for the rest of the, like, the things to happen. Because even at the end of the film, it's him and it's Bruce and Diana sort of talking. And he says, we've got to be ready. Something's coming. I have a feeling. He should be like, no, I saw that, you know, I saw a person appear in my bat cave. And talk to me from the future. Like, I don't know. It feels, again, clunky, where they wanted to do it, but they haven't really thought about how it should work, like how the logistics of it work.
In isolation, it makes no sense whatsoever. If you go on to watch Justice League or the Snyder Cut of Justice League after this film, then it makes more sense.
Yes.
But you can only watch this for the first time in isolation, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it just makes no narrative sense, and you'd be sat there as an audience member going, "What on earth?
Yeah.
What on earth is that? And why? You know, what's the explanation? Is it because it's echoing through time or something? You know, because Barry's going to travel back in time from this apocalypse future to warn Batman." I mean, you know, you read the stories about what was planned for Justice League 2, if that had gone ahead, and that was what was going to happen in that film. But then there's no, you know, there's no sense, there's absolutely no sense to it whatsoever. I've never read any, like, critical theory as to how Bruce sees that in the present day. It makes no sense to me.
No, and even when he does wake up for the second time... from the vision, from the Barry vision, there's papers in the background, like, going whoosh, in the air. So it's as if it's as if something has been there again. So yeah, I know, I find it very confusing. I was like, okay, I get it, because you are foreshadowing, but it just feels kind of weird.
It does. But going back, the that introduction of Wonder Woman. Rather fantastic.
I tell you what, though, I just want to say on the introduction of the Wonder Woman, as you said, it was all over the trailers, and I think that was a mistake.
And Doomsday was as well. They should have kept that.
Exactly. I think the whole third act of this film should have been kept as quiet as possible out of the trailer. Because can you imagine that reaction if you didn't know, if you knew that, you know, Gal Gadot was going to be in this film, but we're not revealing anything about what's going to happen? She's just there. Her new film's coming out. We've just introduced her, blah, blah, blah. Keeping it quiet. If then the first time in the cinema you see that scene, you get a da 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 da, and all of a sudden you see her in costume. That's akin to, like, Captain America picking up Mjolnir in Avengers Endgame, isn't it? That's kind of like a fist pumping, like, oh, shit got real now. Like, it's that kind of thing. Like, you'd have had, it would have been up there if it hadn't have been advertised. It would be up there as one of those moments of, like, do you remember when Wonder Woman was first introduced and we didn't know it was coming?
Yeah.
So another one, I think, bit of a shame, because I think it would have been a great moment. It is cool, but it could have been great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I get the other side of the argument that if you got Wonder Woman in your film, why not market it? because, you know, it's the first ever cinematic live action Wonder Woman, not discounting the TV show, the classic TV show. So I suppose if you've got a, you're going to market it much the same as like Black Adam marketed the fact that, hey, guess what, guys, Superman's in this.
Yeah.
He's in it for 10 seconds in a post-credit scene, but Superman's in it. So please come and watch our film because Cavill's back as Superman. Yay.
Yeah.
So I get their reasons for marketing it because Wonder Woman's the third flagship character that DC have. So I understand that. And, you know, as that trio, that shot of the three of them as well, together,
yeah,
just as they're about to take on this monster, that shot is very, very well, you know, beautifully executed of the three main players in DC Comics history for decades.
Oh, it looks ace. Yeah,
together in live action for the first time ever. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really well framed. Again, this is what Snyder does best. It's really well framed. It looks brilliant.
Yeah.
This is where I think, like, you know, I think if this had come out now, I think marketing has changed for superhero films. I think they would have kept it secret. And I think a trailer with her in it would have been released a week after release.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to keep it a surprise for that first kind of, you know, for those people that go in the first week. And then we're going to drop a new trailer to show her. And it'll, you know, hopefully get a bump for that second week and that sort of thing. A bit like the, you know, a bit like the Thunderbolts / New Avengers kind of thing, where they had the, you know,
yeah,
the second wave of advertising that came out on that sort of front.
Yeah, well, they definitely could have done with it because this film had like a record second week drop off. I mean,
yeah,
it made. I was reading it made something like $874 million, which is a huge amount of money.
Mm.
But half of that was made in its first week. It was something like, at the time, obviously, this is 10 years ago now, or 8 years ago, 9 years ago. Mm. So obviously other films have been out since, but at the time of its release, it was something like the eighth biggest opening film of all time, right? It's fantastic. So it made 400 odd million opening week around the world. Couldn't ask for better. Fantastic. And then in the second week, it had the worst drop off in cinematic history, I guess, because obviously, people who are fans are going to, it's Batman vs Superman, people are going to go and see it. But then, because it didn't do so well critically, no one's going back for repeat viewing, and perhaps people who are slightly more
the casual
fans who are like, I might go and see that, but then if they hear it's not good, they're like, oh, I can't be bothered, I won't bother. And then it had such a huge drop. I mean, a film like this with these characters in should have sailed over $1 billion, especially back then where comic blockbusters were sailing over $1 million every year. It should have. But obviously, it's all opinion, it's art, there's no right or wrong answer, but I guess people didn't like it enough for that to happen. But it's such a bizarre thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think talking about the time it came out, I think, and let's talk with, it's kind of like what this film is.
Hmm.
And how it ends. I mean, you know, we've talked about the great fight, and it is, you know, we've Doomsday, you've got Wonder Woman, you have the Trinity. You literally have a picture of the Trinity stood there. You are starting your DC universe. You've now travelled from Man of Steel. You've now got a shared DC universe, and you've showed your Trinity. How amazing. What are you going to do? I'm going to kill a third of that Trinity. Right at the end of this film. Yeah. Oh, right. Well, that's a choice. Well done. All right.
Yeah.
So they kill Superman off, you know, spoilers, if you haven't already seen this. They kill off Superman at the end of this film. And obviously, he's going to come back. Like, they're doing the death of Superman and you know.
You know, if Doomsday is appearing for the first time, Superman has to die, kind of.
Yeah.
You know?
All right. So, fine. They're doing that.
Yeah.
But it's clear that, what I think, you know, when you know, in decades to come, when they look back at sort of how the marketing these things, they look at the success of, you know, cinema history or like pop culture history, how like Marvel constructed themselves in such a way that, like, you know, the Avengers, the first Avengers film in 2012 was like, you know, the major event film. And you look back on it now and you go, it's good fun. I still really enjoy that film.
Mm.
It's a bit, you know, it has some silly, got plenty of plot holes in it as well, just like this. But it's a great film.
It is.
And they built up to, what is it, like 2 years after this? 2018? Endgame? 18 and 19, I think?
Yeah, 18 and 19, yeah.
So 2018, 2019, you have Endgame and Infinity War and Endgame. And they built up to those sort of films to such an extent, you know, and they'd done so much work to get there that when one of them ends on a cliffhanger of a moment, and you have some great moments there, and then you get to Endgame and you have, like, say, Cap picking up Mjolnir and taking on Thanos, and more than anything, you have the portal scene. You know, Cap stood on his own, shield broken, and using it, but he's still using it to strap it on to break it because he's got a broken arm, and he's about to take on Thanos. And you hear on your left,
even
talking about it, it gives me goosebumps. Like that moment, you go like, and that is an earned moment in history. Of you know, it's Ace, and you can imagine that the executives have gone like, we want this.
Yeah.
We need this. And so they've gone Batman v Superman and gone, that's our Avengers or whatever. And they've gone straight to the end game kind of thing before end game. But, you know, they've gone straight for that thing. And so the end of this film kind of feels like, just what you said, despite it being very operatic in the way that it's done, you know, Superman grabs the kryptonite spear, knowing that it's weakening him as he flies along, holding it to take on Doomsday. Which is cool. It's a great sacrifice. It looks ace. It kind of feels like weirdly anticlimactic as well, because you're going, it's two films in. Clearly he's not dead.
Yeah. Like,
why would they do this? Two films in. This is stupid. This is a really weird choice.
They just were trying to bolt to the finish line without sort of putting the hard yards in, weren't they?
You know? Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah. You've summed it up perfectly. You know, they wanted what Marvel had. Marvel at that point had a flawlessly executed shared universe. One could argue the last few years of Marvel's shared universe haven't hit anywhere near those heights.
Yeah.
Again, that's opinion, but my opinion is then they've been way off it for a few years. But, you know,
yeah,
but I think, you know, what's coming sounds like it's going to be a return to form. But yeah, they obviously wanted that, and obviously they have a ready-made massive universe of beloved comic book characters that all exist in a shared universe. So it's already there. The source material's all there, 80 years worth. Let's put it on the screen. It's a license to print money for Warner Brothers. So yeah, why wouldn't they? But they like you said, they didn't construct it in a methodical way. Before the Avengers film, you had a film for Iron Man, a film for Thor, a Captain America, an Incredible Hulk, and then you put them in the Avengers. And even then you'd introduce Black Widow and Hawkeye and the other films before as well. But with this, you've had a Superman film, okay, standalone, great, we're off to a good start. We'll put Batman in the sequel with Superman, great, okay, that works well. We'll throw Wonder Woman in as well as an extra, and then guess what, we'll introduce Flash, Aquaman and Cyborg. It's tantalizing, but then we won't meet those characters again properly until the Justice League film, which is like two films after this. And the films in between, I think this and Justice League, were Suicide Squad and Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, Wonder Woman, good idea, because she's the third wheel and you have to give her backstory, present her as she is. Fantastic. And Suicide Squad was its own thing, which I enjoyed. But you're going straight to Justice League there with all those characters, and the casual audience might not know much about Aquaman or the Flash, and especially Cyborg. Cyborg is
that's very deep cut. Yeah.
Yeah, it should have been Green Lantern, maybe, or Martian Manhunter. And you're just asking the audience to come along with you, which is fine if you're, you know, the likes of me and you who read those comics and know who these characters are, and are like, oh, great, they're in it, fantastic. But your casual audience is the one that makes you the money, because your core audience will be there come hell or high water. I'll go and watch any old shit at the cinema. If there's a Marvel logo or a DC logo before a film, I'll go and see it, even though I know some of them, you know, beforehand they're going to be bad. I went to see Madam Web. I went to see Morbius. And I knew beforehand they weren't going to be good, but I still felt semi-obliged to go and see them. I'm kind of still at that stage where I'm grateful these things exist.
I get what you mean.
So I feel obliged to go and see them. Craven the Hunter, another one. Morbius Venom. But it's the casual audience that really makes you hit the big bucks, because that's that's who you want to bring in, the people who are on the fence. That makes a difference between your film making 300-400 million and your film making 800-900, even, you know, $1 billion, you know.
Yeah.
You have to hit upon that. So again, it's a discussion for another time, but it was this universe was woefully mismanaged.
Yes.
Woefully mismanaged. Too many course corrections, too many about turns, circumstances of this, that, and the other, which, you know, but yeah, but that's jumping ahead. But yeah, I know what you mean. Killing Superman off so quick when we'd barely got to know him. Perhaps he should have saved that for a little bit further down the line. Let it breathe a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe see an adventure together with these three doing something before we get to that moment. Because by the time you get to Justice League, Superman's dead. So we form the Justice League without Superman.
Yeah.
And then we bring him back at the end for, he only gets involved for the last 15 minutes of the film after we brought him back, in terms of teaming up with the Justice League, I mean. So yeah, it's I get what you're saying. They should have refrained from that, I think. It's fine to do it.
Yeah.
I've no problem with it, and I enjoyed seeing it. But yeah, it should have been perhaps a few years down the line, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Now, even doing the thing before, of like, you know, if you wanted to show the turn of like, you know, you've seen the creation of Cavill Superman, to show the sort of the turn of Batman between Man of Steel and Batman v Superman, there should have been a Batman film that has a Batman pre-Man of Steel, but like, oh, this is a bit of a prequel. Here's him on an adventure and show him being a better man.
Mm-hmm.
And then you show and go, and then that whole line from Alfred saying how we, you know, it's gone darker and more about crime, it has more resonance.
Mm.
But yeah, no, it's one of those weird ones that kind of, you know, as you say, woefully managed, unfortunately.
Yeah. They just wanted to get to the finish line.
Yeah.
Quicker than they should have, you know.
Yeah.
They wanted to catch up to the MCU, but the MCU had several years head start.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. They wanted to compete. Yeah. I think there's one line as we get to the end. There is an acknowledgement from Diana that I really like. Mm. When you see the two different funerals, and you see the one being held in Smallville, it's a small affair, it's got family, everyone's in black, and then you see the one in Metropolis, and it's a big grand affair. And she actually says that, like, you know, they can't see him as anything other than a soldier.
Mm.
And I love that idea that, like, you know, they're trying to give him this military burial and stuff. And you're like, no, but this is, you know, this is what who he was. This is what he should have been, this small town kind of funeral. So I love that moment.
Yeah.
It's
an interesting one, because the whole film's been sort of based upon, you get these real people in the film sort of debating Superman's existence from a theological standpoint, and what it means to us to not be alone in the universe, how the existence of life from beyond the stars impacts our religious beliefs and all the rest of it, and the distrust. But yet the minute he's taken from us, there's this state funeral, and he's you know, the whole world goes into mourning, because, you know, it's, again, it's that kind of Jesus analogy that we talked about in Man of Steel, isn't it? You know, how badly we treated him, and then when he was gone, we realise what we've done, kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and so the end funeral scene, exactly that. And I think, you know, it's oddly sort of prescient. I also like the fact that Bruce has clearly paid for the funeral. And stuff. Oh, yeah, that's kind of a nice little nod and stuff. So, no, I think it ends on a good moment. You have and just before it ends, the sort of thing, you have the casket going in. Lois is throwing some soil in, and you see some soil sort of elevating, as if, like, you know, oh, his aura is still there. Mm. Overall, it's kind of like a mixed experience. There's lots in this film that I enjoy, as in, like, that's good fun. I enjoy that. That's quite cool. And then it's one of those that intellectually I sort of look at it and go, it's kind of a mess. And it kind of ends up eating its own tail. And it's kind of misunderstanding of the characters a little bit. But, you know, it's a vision. And I kind of... As I've got older and I've seen this, I'm not a Snyder fan, in the sort of a dedicated Snyder fan. But I've kind of learned to respect, like, auteur vision. So, you know, go, oh, this is like, he's got a vision. He knows what he wants. He's going to go for that. Right.
Mm.
I still think, you know, his better films were actually his earlier films in his career. you know, Dawn of the Dead, Watchmen, those
300
ones. 300. Yeah. Like, you know, they are a visual feast, and I think they work quite well. This is kind of where I think the bloat, this is where the, it's funny. I literally watched Transformers 2 to talk to with Julian about the other day. And it was funny, we were talking about it and we made the same comparison as you've just said, that like there's this weird sort of similarity between Bay and Snyder, and they've got this visual style that's very recognisable.
Mm.
And I sort of said, it's amazing watching Transformers 2, 2009. I said, who can Bay better than Bay can Bay? You know, and Julian was like, I think Zack Snyder can Bay a little bit better than Bay. And I'm like, that might be right. I think, you know, there's some great visuals, but they have a tendency to overdo things a little bit and lose sight of the story in doing that. And that's what I think I have here. So,
yeah, I mean, I do like Zack Snyder as a filmmaker. I think he has like most filmmakers, he has his good points and he has his bad points. And sometimes his bad points do tend to overshadow his good points. But I do like this film. I can recognise there's a... Oh, we've just spent the last nearly 2 hours discussing all the things that are not quite right about it. But I think as an experience, watching... And, you know, as a DC Comics fan, in some ways, this film feels almost like a love letter to the DC universe. It's Death of Superman meets The Dark Knight Returns, you know. There's literal dialogue lifted straight off the page of Dark Knight Returns. During that the fight, when he's dressed as Batman in The Dark Knight Returns, some of the things he says to Superman when he's, you know, before the Martha thing, that is literally taken off the page of Dark Knight Returns. So as a DC fan, I appreciate the effort that's gone into it, for sure. It's a treat to see, finally, these two characters together in live action as well. Just that. And then you're throwing Wonder Woman into the mix as well. So, okay, so see the three of them together is something for the first time. There can only ever be one first time, of course. And obviously, it's going to happen again, obviously, with as we embark now on James Gunn's vision. You know, we're going to get a Batman in his new universe. We're going to get a Wonder Woman. At some point, the three shall meet and there will be another iteration of the Justice League. It's going to happen over the next decade. Of course, and I'm sure, hopefully it'll be brilliant. I really hope it is. It remains to be seen, but I really hope it is. But there can only ever be one first. So I think, you know, the original, seeing the three of them together is a moment, and the impact of it can never be replicated. So I do like this film. I've always liked this film, but I as I said before, I completely understand the problems that people have with it, and I'm not one of those people who, you know, that lot who shall not be named, who like to shit on everybody that doesn't agree with what Zack Snyder puts out, although they seem to be less and less these days, which is good. I'm not one of those, that's for sure. But I do like Zack Snyder's style, and I do like this film. There's a million things that change about it, but it doesn't stop me liking it. It's a film that I enjoy, and I look forward to watching it again in another few years, probably just to reminisce.
Experience is a right word. I mean, it's an action film. It was an action film. Forgetting the sort of Superman, like, as an action film, as a comic book action film, it's pretty solid. I won't deny it. It's a solid, solid film. It's an enjoyable film. It's only when you get into the lore and some of the other bits and pieces that it kind of starts to, you can pick and choose at it. But I think, you know, we have picked at it. But I think we've tried to sort of say that there are some great things in here as well. Like, you know, some of the depictions, some of the costuming, some of the stylings. So it's a good experience. Anyway, right, we are going to be moving on. And we're not done yet. We're not done with Snyder yet. We have got one thing to go, and Max, you're joining me for the final sort of part of this Snyder thing. And we are going to be doing Zack Snyder's Justice League. We're going to go full bore and do the full Justice League. I am going to watch the Justice League just because I've never done a double watch. So I'm going to do a double watch just for us to say, all right, that's what that was. See what gets what translated across. But yeah, we're going to be talking about Zack Snyder's Justice League, and then we'll be moving on to Superman and you know, the future, see how that goes.
Yeah, I look forward to it very much. Yeah, I've not, again, the Snyder Cut is a film I haven't watched for a few years, probably a couple of years at least. So I look forward to visiting that. I think I'll do the same as you. I'm going to rewatch the abomination that is Justice League.
I would say, see
how the two coexist with each other.
It's going to be interesting because that is a very abomination, but a bit of a strong sense, but it's been a long time. I remember watching it the first time and being like, this has a very, very weird feel to it. This is very weird.
It's one film that's been grafted into something very, very different from what it should have been.
Yes.
I mean, we could do a whole show just talking about the situation around the Justice League and the whole thing without even mentioning what happens in the film.
Yeah.
There's that much to it. I very much look forward to watching a 4 hours of the Snyder Cut. Yeah, it should be interesting.
I'll save a day. Right, anyway. So, Max, anything you're up to, where can people find you and what can people find you doing?
You can find me on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it these days, at Maxi Byrne, which is MaxyByrne. Go on there. There's links to the different websites I write comic reviews and things for and bits and bobs like that. So by all means, check it out. Say hello. Yeah.
Wonderful. All right. And as always, you can find us on the social medias under at 20th Century Geek on all the different social medias. And on all your podcast catchers. And if you really want to talk to more, check out the Patreon, because on the Patreon, we've got loads and loads of new stuff on there. And I've just started doing a new thing, and I'm working my way through Tales from the Crypt. I'm doing Thoughts from the Crypt, and I'm doing all the different horror things on there. So go and check it out. Links down below. But for now, Max, thank you very much for joining us on this. And we shall see you all on the next episode.